Hello and welcome to the Atlanta Opera Podcast, The Business of Opera. They say that there is no business like show business. But at the end of the day, though, it is still a business. And the question that we are interested in exploring here relates to the intersection of classical music and business. The sometimes impossible logic of non-for-profit, like opera companies and symphonies, and questions like, how does it actually work from a business standpoint? Are there ways to grow the business and make it more sustainable? How do we bring new audiences? What is the role of leadership as we continue to forge a path forward? The series is inspired by the programming of the piece, The Revolution of Steve Jobs at the Atlanta Opera in the spring of 2022. It is a brilliant and powerful opera that was written by Mark Campbell and Mason Bates, and premiered at the Santa Fe Opera in 2017, and then went on to win the Grammy Award. It tells the story of an iconic leader that stood right at the intersection of business and art, technology and design, and that is, of course, the character of Steve Jobs. In preparation for the premiere of the show in Austin, Kansas City, and in Atlanta, we will have a series of interviews with business leaders, opera impresarios, artists, and strategic thinkers, as well as creative minds who will focus on two themes. Number one, the business of opera and the role of leadership in this business. And number two, the very controversial and mysterious character of Steve Jobs and the opera written about him. I hope you enjoyed the show. Our first guest is one of the creators of the opera Steve Jobs, the sharp and busy librettist Mark Campbell. Mark has written dozens of operas so far, some of them the most performed operas of our time, including the Grammy winner, The Revolution of Steve Jobs, the Pulitzer Prize winner, Silent Night, which is one of my personal favorites, the opera As One, which we will perform at the Atlanta Opera this spring and is one of the most widely performed operas all over the world. Mark has not only written many operas, but is also deeply invested in mentoring and shepherding young artists, librettists, and storyteller. As a matter of fact, Opera America administers an award that Mark personally sponsors and which gives a prize to an up-and-coming librettist. And it is named after our acclaimed guest.
It means a lot. It means a lot to me, this award, because, I've made the point so many times, but now I'm already digressing. But the source of a good opera for me often is the libretto, and we're kind of the unsung, forgive that pun, we're sort of the unsung heroes of opera, but we often don't get credit for our work, and we also don't have as great a parity as we should in the artistic collaboration. And so the reason I created this award is to just raise the profile of librettists in the industry.
Absolutely. Now tell us a little bit about the opera Steve Jobs. How did the idea start? It's not the most likely subject for an opera, and which is why I think it's so cool. How did it all start for you?
Well, it didn't start with me. I'd love to claim that it did, but it didn't. Maybe all good ideas should, start with someone else. What happened was that Mason Bates called me up and said, hey, I want to collaborate on an opera with you. And of course, I was familiar with his music and very excited about it. And I called him back, and then he told me what the subject matter was, Steve Jobs. So I went, oh, damn. I mean, my heart sunk because I was uneducated about the man. I assumed so many things about him. I had not even read the Walter Isaacson biography at that point, as half the universe had. But I just thought, well, who is this horrible capitalist man who was so mean to everyone? And I have every one of his products. But I had the toaster size Mac in 1984. That's how much of a devotee of Apple I've been. But at the same time, it didn't interest me until I started doing my research. And I started just uncovering things about him that I understood and agreed with and also felt parallel to in my own life. That's how it, once once you find your way into a subject, and honestly and authentically find your way into a subject, it will reveal things to you that make it into a, you know, that become a story.
Exactly. You know, one of the reasons I love operas and opera characters, and I love directing operas, is because it's full of humanity. And humanity is full of ambiguity. There's no black and white, especially in the operas that you write, but also classically, if you think about Mozart and Da Ponte's Count in Marriage of Figaro, Don Giovanni, or Wagner's Wotan in Flying Dutchman, or Verdi and Boito's Falstaff, they're characters that are a combination of obnoxious and charming, charismatic and all too human. And that's where I think Steve Jobs is kind of fits the bill of classic opera characters. Some people see him as an absolute monster. Mm-hmm. Some people absolutely idolize him. We're going to talk to both kinds of people in this podcast. I've already spoken to quite a few. Everybody feels very strongly about him. Where did you stand and what did you discover?
Well, my job is to humanize him. I couldn't create... Who wants to sit through 2 hours of a monster? I mean, you know, I guess Macbeth might be an exception to that. But still, Macbeth is humanized in a way. And I think I did receive some criticism from critics, who cares, but because I didn't create their version of what they wanted to see. Everyone kind of wanted me to vilify him. And I didn't really want to do that. I don't think that that's a good story. Nor lionizing him is a good story. Either one, like in between, it's you have to find the character. You have to find the faults. You have to find the qualities about them. And the more I read about Steve Jobs, the more I learned to like him. And at the same time, I don't think that our opera avoids the bad side of Steve Jobs. When he has his bad behavior, we show it. But at the same time, well, for my own, I mean, if you don't mind me, like, I'll take this one step further. In my process, as I was reading about him, I discovered that he was a Buddhist for his adult life, and that he had a spiritual advisor, Kobunshino Arugawa. And I was like, okay. I mean, there were lots of hippies who found a spiritual advisor and then were the worst capitalists in the world. But where's the in-between space? And the more I read about Kobun, the more I really knew I had to make him a character. And as I started to read about Buddhism and meditation, Steve was meditated, I think every day, I call him Steve, that's how well I know him, meditated almost every day of his life. And I took a few meditation classes. I know that's hard to believe, but just to learn what that the essence of that is. And at the same time, I started looking at the symbol that came to me is the Enzo, which is the symbol that Buddhist monks paint every day. And the idea is that you draw a circle. And the idea is that the circle is never perfect. It's never going to be perfect. And we should honor that and accept that. That was my way into this story, which, as you know, is a circular story. The title, The Revolution of Steve Jobs, refers to revolving in a circle more than the tech revolution that he helped create.
Well, and that's what I love about the libretto and the opera is that there's a real dichotomy between this mogul, this business mogul, and Zen Buddhism, between minimalism and absolute access, between this idea of a hippie, a barefoot hippie that needs a shower, and a very wealthy yuppie at some point in his life. But now Walter Isaacson's book, which I highly recommend, it's incredible, is over 600 pages. There's dozens of characters. At the beginning of the book, he lists all the characters, which I find illuminating. But even 600 pages is not complete to capture the life of this genius, this giant. How do you pare it down? How do you make decisions to which characters to focus on in an opera that lasts 95 minutes?
Well, the Walter Isaacson book, I sped through it. I mean, like, it might be 600 pages, but it is just like, it's really so well written and it's so easy to read that you can digest this man pretty quickly from that book. But then I decided, okay, now I'm going to do my online research and read every single other thing that I could. What I do is Gosh, I've used this image recently, so forgive me to other people who've heard it, but you're presented all of these events in a person's life. And for me, it's sort of like sifting for gold. You've got a lot of sand in this sieve, and suddenly these gold pieces kind of emerge. And for me, because of the way I connected with it, some of those little gold nuggets, like his work with Waz, I knew I had to, there had to be a scene when they decided to come up with the first Mac. I mean, they had already come up with it, but they were taking it further. His taking acid was a very important moment in his life, as it was in mine. I used to sell acid, and I am not endorsing drug use, God. But I knew it was an important moment in his life. He said as much. He said, taking acid changed my life. His relationship with Chris Ann had to be explored because it really showed his cruelty as a person. And of course, the opposite side of that is when he met Lorene, and his love for her, and also how he let her into his life, and how she also helped him transform himself. They're just key moments. And Tomer, I wish I could analyze them in some way for me, but for me, they just sing. They feel like they sing.
Yeah. I'd love us to kind of think about him versus, or in relationship to our business. So this idea of think different, which was such a fundamental thing for him, how does it apply? Does it apply to us in opera?
I don't know if it applies to us in opera, but I mean, it's an ad campaign. So because I worked in advertising, the psychology behind it is if you buy an apple, you will be thought of as an individual and you will be on the same level as John Lennon. It was a great campaign. It worked so well. And it, very few words, but it just said, buy an apple and you will be equal to these people. So as far as opera goes, think different. Well, we're an opera. We've already thought different, haven't we? I mean, like, we took on this weird art form and are trying to make it relevant and fun and new. I'm going to say fun. Entertaining, a word that is one of the most controversial words you can use about the performing arts. And yes, I mean, we had to do that to do opera. The other thing about opera we have to do all the time is collaborate. And that gives me the greatest joy. Even when it's the hardest thing in the world to collaborate, it is also, I think for you as well, I think it's what keeps us going in this business is the chance to work with these brilliant colleagues who all think different.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not an art form where it's a single person in a room with a pen or a brush.
It never works that way.
But let's talk a little bit about that. So you and I have worked together on the second production of Silent Night.
Yeah.
And we worked together on the world premiere of Dinner at Eight. And I think this is our third production together. Steve Jobs, this production is the second production in the history of the piece. Tell us a little bit about why is it important to have second productions for someone who writes so many premieres?
Well, gosh, I mean, you're the king of second productions, but I mean, and I appreciate that. What happens is that in opera, in the business of opera, an opera opens and, you know, like it opens at Santa Fe. It's a big deal. It's a huge deal. Fortunately, in the original production of Santa Fe, three other companies signed on to do the opera after it opened, which is a wonderful thing. And those were Seattle, San Francisco, and University of Indiana, the Jacobs School of Music. And that's great. And we're still waiting for the big production of San Francisco that got delayed because of the pandemic. But at the same time, for an opera to enter the repertory, it really has to have a kind of a robust second production. And that's the one where opera companies around the country, and we hope globally, say, oh, this has legs. This is something worth doing. I've been very lucky and that a number of my operas have second productions, are going to have second productions. But I also have a number of operas that were like, okay, I think that's kind of it. I don't know why that happens. I wouldn't necessarily say it's the quality of the opera. I would say it has to do with timing and how the opera reaches its audience. And when Steve Jobs went to Seattle, I was so pleased when Aidan Lang reported that it was the most popular opera in Seattle opera history. They do a survey there. And that made me very happy. And I was there opening night. The audience was there. It sold really well. All of those things contribute to having a second production, but are also a result of having a second production.
Absolutely. And this is a piece that I believe is going to remain in the repertoire for many years to come, just as Silent Night is, just as S1 is. One of the big important parts of this piece is your collaboration with this great composer, this talented, incredible guy, Mason Bates. Tell us a little bit about that collaboration, about Mason.
I had heard of Mason before he approached me to write this opera, and I loved, I'd heard Mothership, which is his kind of signature orchestral piece. And I also was really thrilled that he has a side career as a DJ, because I love going out, I love dancing, and I love clubs. But the thing that I loved about his music most is that it had this incredible, this incredible kinetic energy to it. It is certainly complicated and complex, but that's not the card he plays. He plays the emotion card and the energy card. And so much contemporary music is, for me, I mean, contemporary music and opera can get so wound up in complexity that we don't hear anything except the composer. We don't even hear the story. And I knew that Mason was going to be a great opera composer. Collaborating with him was there were challenges because we had different views of Steve Jobs. Mine was more negative than his. He really loved the man, and it was like I went a little too far in the in criticizing. So I attribute Mason during our collaboration with making the story perhaps more emotionally sensitive, and I'm going to use the word sweeter. I had written something initially I think that was a little too harsh, and he had me soften it in a way. And it was just exciting sometimes, Tomer, when the composer sends you something we play, or even sends you, I remember like weeping. There's an exchange that Steve Jobs and Kogun have early on where they talk about Steve Jobs dying. And the sensitivity that Mason gave that and the gravity is really, it's recit. It's not the place where you put a lot of emotion. Recit is just mostly about delivering information. And there are so many things like that. I mean, it was a very exciting collaboration.
You know, my test for operas is my 5-year-old Maya. when I take her to school in the morning, often I play the opera that I'm thinking about, that I'm working on. And she either responds or she doesn't care. And when she responds, I listen very carefully. And when she is listening to Steve Jobs, she sees a whole world when she listens to the music and hears the text. And she has very specific visual imagery. Like when we listen to the rise and fall of Steve Jobs, when he gets fired from Apple, she's like, "Abba, I hear the tornadoes and they're coming to hunt him. Is he going to be okay?" I mean, it's that kind of, and I think it's such an immediate piece that really touches people's heart. Do you feel that in performances? Because that's something I heard from a lot of the singers that were involved in the premiere and the first production. Do you feel that the response of the audience for this piece is different than other pieces that are done on the stage?
Yes, I would, because I also think the makeup of the audience is different. There were a lot of younger people there, which, thank God, I'm grateful for that. I'm tired of looking out in an opera house and seeing people like me, which means older and white. One thing I loved about this opera is that it's attracting a whole new generation of people to the opera house. And we really saw that in Santa Fe, as promotion, they had me sit in the gift shop signing CDs.
Uh-huh. And in a big throne? Do you have a big throne?
Oh, and you know, like velvet ropes and everything. No, honestly.
Carpet.
Nothing like that at all. But there were so many young people who would come up to me and say, this is my fourth time and I'm going for the final performance, you know, like, and I was just so thrilled with that. So I think, yes, I do. I also think Mason's music is unlike other music we've heard in the opera house. First of all, you know, he's using his synthesizers and everything like that. It's might. Which I think is very appropriate for this subject matter. I don't have a problem with that. So, like, essentially, it's louder. And that's a good thing, especially for someone like me who's, you know, suffering hearing loss.
I think it's a perfect pairing, you know, him and this subject matter, because Steve Jobs himself loved music so much. I mean, he reinvented this whole idea of music and iTunes and how we listen to music, and his obsessiveness about Bob Dylan and his bootlegs. And so
Ella Fitzgerald
and connecting like popular pop and opera, I think is super, super powerful.
Well, you've heard me say this before. I view opera as a populist art form. I think it will only survive if we remove the elitism and the snobbery that we've seen in so much contemporary opera. And this is the best example of a populist opera to
super,
me.
Super, super populist.
Opposed to a pop opera.
Yeah, yeah. Now let's talk a little bit about the future of opera, since this is a perfect segue. We lived in this great time of renaissance of opera. You wrote over 40 operas in the past couple of decades. There are dozens of operas written every year. There's real focus on new works. And you have, as we mentioned, a special passion to support younger storytellers and the art form. How do you see opera in the future in America and worldwide?
Well, it's really hard for me to predict. I'm actually writing an article for the Dramatists Guild about the last two decades. What people are calling it, the golden age of American opera. And we don't know yet. We'll learn about that when we're long dead, I think. As far as the future of opera goes, well, that's really hard for me to predict, but I do think as long as we keep telling our stories, as long as we keep working toward our audiences reflecting our population, and as long as we remember that opera is entertainment first, all stories are entertainment first, then I think we have a great chance of this art form that we love continuing on. If we forget those things, then opera deserves to die. It deserves to go where it was going, like in the 50s and 60s. It was pretty much and of course I know there were great operas being written then. There's someone in your audience going, how can you say that? But I do think that we have to keep, you know, we live in a really scary, difficult time. We live in a really scary, difficult country. We have a lot to write about. We have a lot of issues that we need to look at. And they need to be looked at as stories with music, because the music provides the depth and the emotion that words alone don't do. That's what opera has done for how many centuries.
When we think about Steve Jobs and Walter Isaacson starts his book and the first introduction, he talks about how Steve called him and asked him to write a book about him. Crazy question. What do you think Steve would think about the opera if he watched it?
It's not a crazy question. I've never thought of it. And so I've never thought of it because for me, Steve Jobs himself became a fictional character. There is no way I could have written it if I did not view him as a fictional character, that this is a fictional story. Let's imagine that it's not Steve Jobs at all, that it's this crazy hippie in California who invents or finds a way to help invent some great technological ideas. That's the way you have to approach a real subject. You have to leave behind who the real person and create something that becomes a character. So how would he view this? I'm sure he would criticize every other word because that's the way he was. And I would love to sit down with him and justify every single word that I have in the libretto. I mean, he'd win. It is his life, Jesus, not mine. I do think that he would like the message, the ultimate message of the opera. I think he would like the scene where he equates the relationship someone should have with the computer is like a relationship you should have with a musical instrument. I think right. He'd like those things. I think he'd probably want a little bit more in the relationship with Laureen, but then I'd have to say, we've got an hour and a half, you know, like I can't, you know, I can only do so much.
I think he would get it as somebody who worked on Toy Story and Pixar. I think he understands. He
would I do understand too. I think toward the end of his life, when he became the more enlightened Steve Jobs, I think he'd like it. Yeah.
I'm still caught with this idea that you mentioned that in order to write about somebody, they have to be fictional. So in other words, in order to humanize somebody, you have to dehumanize them first and make them a character.
You do your research and then you throw away your research. Yeah. You put it in your brain somewhere where you can access it when you need to. But if you're writing research, then go write a research report. Go write an article. Don't write an opera. I'm working on a oratorio about Jewish refugees in Shanghai in 1938. And the research was done by these experts for me, and they were wonderful. But there was a certain point where I had to say, I don't need another fact. I will make this story true and I will make it authentic, but I don't need another fact right now. Because it has to exist as a story, not as a research paper.
I love that. I say that all the time about directing. You know, you're not writing an essay about the opera. If people don't feel deeply the story, you haven't done your job.
No one is going to stand up in an audience and say, well, that didn't actually happen. A lot of people will stand up and say, that's really boring.
And I look forward to the premiere.
Me too. I'm very excited. Thank you, Tomer. Thanks for all your work. Thanks for all your work during the pandemic, by the way. Atlanta Opera was a leader in the industry during that time. And that quote that you had, I don't remember, but it's on your email signature about, like, you know, when there's a crisis, that's when we try to do better, we work harder. And I think you really demonstrated that. So thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Okay. We'll talk to you later.